Hello, and welcome to Diving into Diabetes, the podcast where we explore the latest advances in best practices on individuals' diabetes care. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Gilbert, and with me on the program is Dr. Peter Lin. Dr. Lin is the Director of Primary Care Initiatives at the Canadian Heart Research Center. He is also a contributing author to the Canadian Diabetes Guidelines in 2013 and 2018. Moreover, Dr. Peter Lin is a great friend of mine, and we've done lots of talks together, and he's awesome. So we're in for a great treat today. Today, we'll be discussing managing diabetes in the elderly, a primary care perspective. So Dr. Lin, from a primary care perspective, how do you prioritize and overall give us an approach to type 2 diabetes management when caring for an elderly patient versus a younger patient?
Thanks very much, Jeremy. Usually it's me asking you questions. This is kind of cool. So thanks very much for having me. And I think the key thing is with the elderly, we worry about cardiovascular disease. And thankfully, we now have lots of medications for cardiorenal benefits these days in diabetes. They have more comorbidities, which means they're on more medications. So drug interactions now become a concern. The elderly, they tend to not eat as much or eat more sporadically, you know, the tea and toaster. So they might not have a whole lot of meat in their diet, or they might forget to eat those kinds of things. And therefore, hypoglycemia is of some concern as well. So, and they're not as well aware of the hypoglycemia. So then we have to get rid of things like SUs and the other medications that might be offending things or protect them a little bit better against that. Their memory is also something to be concerned about. Some of them forget their medications. So that's why, you know, a lot of times we try to do a quick mini mental test, like the mini cog, for example. So I always tell our medical students, you know, why don't you just ask the patient, remember three words, ball, cat, tree, and then tell them to repeat it back to you. And then just have them draw a clock that says 10 after 11. And then just ask them for the three words again. If they can't remember the three words, they're three times more likely to have dementia. If they have an abnormal looking clock, they're 24 times more likely to have dementia. So therefore, we can use these very simple screening tests to make sure that the patients can go home and follow the instructions of all these medications that we're giving to them. And more importantly, if they can't follow it, then we can bring them back and assess them further. So with the elderly, we do take more care just to make sure that they're nutritionally okay and that they know what to do with their medications when they get back home.
Yeah, no, that's very helpful, Dr. Lin. You know, I think you highlighted the concern to me around cognitive impairment in this population that could be a higher concern, and of course the risk for hypoglycemia. So with that, how do you determine and tailor appropriate glycemic targets for those elderly people living with type 2 diabetes who might be more frail?
Yeah, so we always worry about hypoglycemia. I remember in medical school, that was the thing that you were worried about, right? So you caused the problem because you gave some medication and they caused hypoglycemia. And so that's why a lot of times we tend to run them a little higher. So therefore, we'll let the A1Cs be a little bit higher so that we can avoid the hypoglycemia risk. Because when we control them very tightly, there is a risk that we're going to send them a little further down. Now, it depends on their frailty, as you were mentioning, right? If they're really frail, then we're not as aggressive. If they have comorbidities, let's say they have metastatic cancer or something like that, or they've got multiple diseases going on, renal failure and things like that, we may ease up a bit. And how much life is left? In other words, are they close to sort of end of life, in which case do we really need to be so aggressive with our therapy? So all of those things play a role in our thinking process. So for example, let's say you have a patient in a nursing home sort of curled up with dementia. You know, tight control of glycemia isn't really the greatest thing in the world that that person needs. Now, we don't want the sugars to go crazy because we can cause a lot of harm. We can cause infections, you know, if their sugars are really high, we can cause diuresis, electrolyte imbalances. So we want to avoid those things. But let's say on the other hand, you have an active elderly person living in the community, same age, but that person, we would want to tightly control their sugar because they still have a lot of longevity and life left. So we don't want sugar sticking all over the place inside their blood vessels. So I tell my patients, we've got about 60,000 miles of blood vessels. And unfortunately, sugar sticks to proteins inside the blood vessel wall. So therefore, it can do damage to any of those blood vessels by sticking to them. And so that's why we would have damage in all these multiple organs. Like the eyes, the brain, the heart, the kidneys, and the circulation into your legs. So if we have a very healthy older person, then we still would like to be a more aggressive and keep their A1Cs down. And I tell patients A1C is a measurement of the sugar sticking inside your body. I can't take biopsies of your eyeball to see how much sugar is sticking, but the sugar sticking to your blood, I can measure that. And that's what we're using as a marker. And a lot of times I also tell them that, you know what, you get new red blood cells, but you don't get new retina, you don't get a new heart, you don't get a new kidney. So let's just control your sugar so that it's not sticking to those places. And so therefore, longevity patients, people that are doing well, we're going to be a little bit more aggressive with them. People that are sort of at the terminal stages of their life, then we're going to be a little bit more flexible and less aggressive because the benefit won't be there for them as much as the healthier elderly.
And thank you very much for that. I think you highlighted for me the importance of hypoglycemia, which really is important for anybody with diabetes, right? Especially if they're on insulin. But I guess the question is, why is this in particular a heightened concern when talking about our population today? Like in the elderly people, why is hypoglycemia such an important concern?
Yeah, I think a couple of reasons. One is that in medical school, hypoglycemia was something that we did, right? In other words, we gave the insulin or we give the medication, an SU, and then we caused the hypoglycemia. And as doctors, we don't want to cause these problems. The major problem, though, is that the elderly cannot feel the hypoglycemia symptoms. So therefore, if they, you know, you make their sugars go down, they won't get the sweaty and the tachycardia and those kinds of things like a normal person would. And so therefore, they won't feel it on the way down. And then all of a sudden, you get to those critical lows without them actually noticing that they're going down. And we see that with the elderly, whether we're talking about dehydration, they don't feel it. And certainly with the hypoglycemia, they don't feel it. So that's why we have to be a little bit more careful with that. On the other hand, you know, I always remember that beta cell loss curve, you know, where it says, here's your beta cells going down. For the elderly, they've lost a lot of beta cells. So they're exactly the ones that need insulin replacement, right? Because they're low in that. And then that's exactly the group of people that we're holding back on. So now I tell my patients, it's kind of like you have low thyroid. I need to replace your thyroid. So I tell patients your insulin is low. So therefore we need to replace your insulin. So it's replacement therapy and patients seem to like that. And then how we tell the patients how we're using the insulin is important. I used to tell patients, you know, I thought I was so smart, 10 units every night and then increase one unit every single night. And then all of them sort of stopped around 18 units. And couldn't figure out why until I asked one. They said, because when I got to 18 units, I'm almost double where I started. I must be going up too much. So therefore, I just stopped. So a lot of people just stopped there. So now what I do is I tell them right from the beginning, your weight is this much. You need about 40 units of insulin. But just to be super cautious, we're going to start you at 10 units a night. And then you're just going to increase by one unit every single night. And then we're going to head our way very slowly up towards that 40 that you most likely need. Now, if you only need 30, that's great. We'll stop there. And this way, they know that they need to march towards 40, but that we're also being very careful. And therefore, the risk of hypoglycemia is lower and the risk of side effects are lower. So by doing it this way, insulin is no longer scary for the patient, because we're telling them that we're doing it very slowly and carefully. And it's also less scary for me as a family physician starting insulin, because now in my mind, I know they need 40, we're starting at 10. I feel much more comfortable, patients feel much more comfortable. And I think that's a very good way to do it. And I've sort of stumbled upon that method only because I ran into a lot of walls the other ways that I was doing it.
No, I appreciate that, because that's a very practical strategy around, you know, trying to titrate insulin appropriately to reduce the risk of hypoglycemia, but still get to target. And would you agree that that's something that can be done at the primary care level?
Yeah, very much so. I think in the past, right, we were a little bit nervous to start insulin. We always thought this is an endocrinologist kind of area because it seemed magical, you know, like you would come up with all these numbers, give this many units of insulin and those kinds of things. And we would look at you like a magician pulling out these numbers. But I think with the basal insulin strategy, I think it's very reasonable for us to do that. And then so we tell the patient, you're low in the insulin area, let's help out your pancreas. And I think that area is something that primary care can do very well. And I think in the past, I remember for lipids, we used to send it to the lipid clinic, right, before we used the statin. And they would come back, they put them on a statin, right? So I think we became very comfortable with statin. ACE inhibitors, I still remember, they said, you have to be very careful. And then we used to send them to the nephrologist and things. And then now we're taking over. So insulin, very easily we can take over as well, especially if we're going slowly and we're starting at these low levels. The patients feel comfortable, and I think primary care feels comfortable too.
Yeah, I wanted to follow up with something that you said before, even on the comorbidities. You know, when you were talking about that population, you know, when it comes to that issue around hypoglycemia, you have somebody who's elderly, and you very nicely described how their reaction time to hypoglycemia may be diminished in this elderly population, therefore poses a higher risk for hypoglycemia. But those comorbidities then can even multiply that risk, right? Because they may also have impaired renal function, which predisposes to hypoglycemia. Their nutrition may not be as good, which predisposes to hypoglycemia. So this is certainly a population where we want to do well by them and treat them properly and get them into target, but at the same time, minimize risk. So I guess in that context, if we're going to be using insulin and basal insulins, we have to kind of think of what is the best basal insulin for that, you know, person, right? And there's so many different new basal insulins out there. So I guess, Dr. Lin, from a primary care perspective, how do you decide around basal insulins given all the choices?
Yeah, it's tough, right? Because our head is spinning, right? Every day there's something else that somebody is saying, this one is better. I think the first thing I think to myself and I think to my patients and I tell them is that our body actually uses regular insulin, like short-acting insulin. The pancreas just puts out a basal amount. And then when you eat more then it puts out more insulin for you. So it's like a flat line and then it goes up like a hill around mealtime. And so the way we think about it is that we can help the pancreas by taking care of the basal amount. So it's kind of like me saying, I will pay for your rent, Jeremy. So therefore, and you want me to be very consistent, right? You want me to pay it every single month. So basal insulin should be as flat as possible, very predictive and predictable amounts and effect. Now, when we had MPH, it wasn't really flat. It was more like a hill. And so there was a peak in the middle of the night. So therefore, people got hypoglycemia at night. And that scared doctors and patients because we can't tell if they're having anything because they're in the middle of the night. The next generation insulins like glargine was much better, was flatter. And then the current generation of insulins are even flatter. So that means less peaks, less hypoglycemia. So a much safer option for our patients and much safer option for family doctors to be using. So we'll have more peace of mind, for example. And one of the technologies that they use to make it longer is they actually take the insulin molecules and they pack it tighter together into a ball. So now you have less surface area. And so therefore the insulin is released slower. And therefore a flatter profile, and then you have less hypoglycemia. And so therefore the technology is quite amazing in terms of how do they make these things flatter as we speak. And so if we have that little ball sitting underneath the subcutaneous tissue, for example, there might be more access to it locally because it's sitting there for longer. So therefore some of the insulin might be degraded locally. So even though you might need to use a few more units, the units aren't really going into the bloodstream. It's being degraded at the local spot. But the benefit of that is that we get this nice flat profile, which is a good choice for our elderly population because we do have a higher risk of hypoglycemia. So anything that reduces that would be helpful. And in fact, if you think about it, for anybody taking insulin, you don't have to be elderly. Reducing hypoglycemia is a good idea. And so this new technology kind of way of doing insulin, I think is really good. And I just think that we need to appreciate some of the smart people that are behind these nice flat curves that we just see for an instant on a PowerPoint presentation. There is really a lot of good thought that went into it.
It makes a lot of sense, everything you've said. I guess a follow-up question might be, what are some of the challenges at the primary care level when faced with, you know, starting, initiating, managing basal insulin in this elderly population? So you talked about what works well. What do you find is one of the bigger challenges?
Yeah, there's tons of challenges, like who's going to give the insulin? Are they going to know what to do? Can they check their sugars and all those kinds of things? So this is where sometimes we can use technology. So CGM, for example. So now all of a sudden we don't rely on the patients poking themselves. We can get their numbers. We can see what their numbers are live, kind of speak, and therefore we can help them monitor in that way. We can have people coming in to help them with the insulin shots, teach the family members, for example, so that way the family member will know what to do. teach them about what lows look like and why we're going so slowly, et cetera. And that way, by having many people involved, that would be good. And that's why this sort of multidisciplinary care is involving the patient, the family, in terms of trying to pull everybody together. So that way the patient is safe and is getting the beneficial effects of insulin, for example, in this particular case.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me. I think just the second generation basal insulins, which you were highlighting before, how they are helpful in terms of reducing hypoglycemia. The other thing is because they last more than 24 hours, you could give it in morning or night or in the middle of the day, like whenever that caregiver is around to help, whatever's convenient. So it's not like you have to give it before bed when there's nobody around. So that's a great point and a great way of kind of addressing one of those challenges. So I guess considering the unique needs of elderly people living with type 2 diabetes, when you talk about that effective multidisciplinary team in primary care, what are the hallmarks for that? Like, what are the best ways of kind of approaching an effective multidisciplinary team for primary care in the elderly?
Yeah, I think the elderly just have so many issues, right? Like, we really need everybody to be looking out for them, right? So that means pharmacists, nurses, PSWs, you know, their personal social work care workers, family doctors, specialists, everybody needs to be on the same page watching out for them. And even though we don't have to be in the same building, right? In other words, the same office, that kind of thing. So a lot of times people think that multidisciplinary means that everybody's in the same spot. But if everybody that's looking after that patient is on the same page, we're coming from the same guidelines, we're looking after the same issues, then that nice overlap, it's kind of like one coat of paint is good, two coats is better, three coats is even better. So therefore, we'll have multiple people watching this. For example, if you look at the pharmacists, right, the pharmacists probably see the patient more often than we as family doctors. They will know whether they're filling their prescriptions on time. They can see if they're taking their pills. If all of a sudden they're not renewing one of the medications, then have they forgotten to take that pill? They can help out with blister packing, for example. I had one patient who was blister packing, and the nurse went to see him, and this one was poked out, this one was poked out, and this one put, and they said, why is it all randomly poked out? They go, oh, I just pick it up and I just blister pack one of them. He didn't know that there was an up direction. So we had to put blue tape, and we said, blue tape is sky, so make sure it's upward and then you can blister down. So we can have that to help. They can also, pharmacists can notice mobility issues, vision issues. So if they can't see properly, they might not be taking their medications or their insulin properly. And they can always see the memory issues because all of a sudden they become forgetful when they're in the store. So these could be all critical pieces of information. And we just need a way to pass that information back and forth. So perhaps the pharmacist can send us a fax. We can talk to the pharmacist. If they're in the building, that's helpful. So these are things that we might want to think about how we can pass the information around. But basically, primary care, endocrinologists, pharmacists, everybody, we should be overlapping in our care for the elderly. And like I said, with CGM and stuff like that, we can actually have access to information so that we can take care of them, or family members can have access to that information to make sure that they're well treated and that they're not getting into trouble. So I think with the elderly, just to make sure that they don't get into trouble, all eyes should be on elderly, and the more eyes, the better. So therefore, primary care, specialty care, pharmacists, nurses, everybody working from the same page. And that way we'll make sure that the patients have the protection of the medication while we minimize the side effect of any of the medications that we're giving them.
Well, thank you, Dr. Lin, for your valuable insight. And I wanted to thank all of you for listening to this latest installment of the Diving into Diabetes podcast. We hope you enjoyed our deep dive into managing diabetes in the elderly, a primary care perspective. If you found this discussion helpful for your clinical practice, consider sharing this episode with your colleagues by clicking the share button. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and stay tuned for new releases.